Judge Jim's Big Debate on Tracks FM.
Welcome. I don't know if I mentioned it to you last week in the Big Debate, where there was a lack of news. Unfortunately, it's quite the opposite this week. Unfortunately, an unfortunate attack that unfolded here in London, in the UK, this afternoon. So, with no further ado, take it away, Judge.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. Big welcome out there to all our listeners to Tracks FM's Big Debate here. I'm just outside London, and of course we received news about 2 hours ago of what was thought to be a terrorist incident. It's now been proved that it is, or it's been considered as one. The government has chaired, or is in the process of chairing, a COBRA emergency meeting. The latest updates are, looking at Twitter, the Evening Standard has tweeted, "Police among four dead in London's worst terror attack since 7/7, with some very graphic pictures of victims and whatnot. There's also a picture of one of the alleged attackers being carted off into an ambulance. So he's probably been kept alive. I'd be interested to see how he responds to questioning. A lot of people on social media are going absolutely bananas, but I just want to try and put the lid on some of this boiling hatred. This, listeners, is exactly what these people want. Okay? Calm it down. Let's get on with our lives. Let's walk the streets feeling proud, because there's no way these people are going to dictate in our lives. So when I turn on social media and I see people having a rant and a rave, for example, there's lots of stills and lots of cartoons from, I think it's Family Guy or The Simpsons, of a news reader saying, "Terrorist attack in London. Oh, and it's the Muslims." No, it isn't the Muslims. I've got lots of Islamic friends, Muslim friends, that are very gentle, very kind people, very generous people, and are very good people, hardworking people. So let's calm it down quite a lot, right? Let's get that bit done. These people are terrorists that so happen to be Muslim. Maybe they're not, because if you sit a spiritualist Muslim down and say, "What do you think of these people? Are they Muslim in your eyes?" Some Muslims will turn around and say they're not with that sort of behaviour. They can't be. They're just calling themselves that. So let's look at ourselves about the labelling, first of all, of other people, other groups that we all live with. We all know that, you know, I live in a very small market town. There's about 30, 35,000 people that live here. And it's like the time that land forgot in some respects. But when I want to go to the pub or to the airport, I phone a taxi company. Who's there to drive me? A Muslim man. When I go to the Indian, who's there to ask for my second course? A Muslim man. Who serves me a kebab at the kebab shop? A Muslim man, or woman in some cases. So let's not label, "Oh, it's the Muslims, they're all like that, or they're all coming over here to do these things." They're not. Okay, let's just get that straight. The second point that I want to get across is that, whilst, because really my main feature of the show originally this morning when I was putting it together was going to be about Martin McGuinness. If you don't know who he is, then you soon will do. But whilst Britain and the US and a lot of Western countries are going halfway around the world and doing exactly the same, using superior military force and technology, you're actually feeding and giving reasons to these individuals to carry on in the same way. And that's what you've got to understand. In fact, I had a friend of mine that lives up the road. He was talking about something else, but the main reason he was calling was to have a rant at this. And I said, "Look, you're giving these people license to do this whilst you're flying drones around the world to take out communities in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and whilst you've got Israeli police picking up Palestinian children and shooting them regardless." And that's before we even move on how the UK and the US and a lot of other so-called Western civilizations treat their own citizens, let alone people abroad. And whilst you've got that inequality gap, you're going to have these problems. So look, let's go about our daily lives. There's no need for this pictures of tube profile pictures on your Facebook saying we're not afraid. Well, you shouldn't be afraid. But next time you put, if you do put that picture up, when there's a bombing in Istanbul or a bombing in Palestine or an airstrike in Palestine, put a picture of the Palestinian flag up. You know, offer some equilibrium here, some equity, some balance. It is a nasty attack that's taken place. I mean, I've almost lost someone very close to me in one incident, if not two. And it was a sympathiser in the other incident. But you'll have to buy me a pint and I'll tell you all about those two incidences another time. But look, your friends are Muslim, okay? They're your friends, not these people. Go about your daily business. Whatever you've got planned for tomorrow, carry on. Because if you don't, you're going to let them win. Don't. Carry on. Carry on, whatever it is you're going to do. But remember, it's not the Muslims. It's a very small minority of people that just so happen to be what they call themselves as Muslims. Anyway, look, I was going to start off with... let's have a look here. I mean, the newspapers, are particularly The Guardian, is it starts off, we'll come back to this later if we get time. Covert Met Police unit accused of using hackers to spy on protesters. It gives you a flavour of what your government's all about. I mean, it's good to see some compassion. I saw on Twitter a picture of an MP out in the street there helping and assisting with first aid with a lot of the victims that are out there. But, I mean, it just does go to show some of them are human after all. But it makes some worrying reading when you read on the front page headline that Covert Met Police unit accused of using hackers to spy on protesters. But we'll come back to that, as I said, a bit earlier. I just want to touch on... what some people might regard as a terrorist, some people might regard as a peacemaker, and some people might regard as a soldier. The IRA, or Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness, as you know, has died. And there's lots of interesting articles today in The Guardian and The Times. And this is what this gentleman says. His name is Jonathan Powell, and he was chief of staff to Tony Blair and chief negotiator on in Northern Ireland from 1997 and 2007. And I think it's fair to say that this Jonathan Powell is somewhat of an inside man that could give us an opinion on the man Martin McGuinness. Now, we want to hear from you what you consider Martin McGuinness as. And you can, if you're out and about, of course, you could tweet in at This Is Jim Tracks FM. You can Skype in if you want to come on air live. That's entirely up to you. We can put you through. And of course, you can join in our chat room. If you're already on www.tracksfm.org, just go to the top of the web page. You'll see a home schedule, chat room, listen back, all the rest of it. If you click on chat room, you can come in as a guest. That way you can remain anonymous if you just want to sample today's show. Be our guest, quite literally. Or indeed, you can register a nickname or a username or a handle, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, look, turning back, this is what this article says. The ex-IRA man made the Good Friday Agreement work, but now power sharing is under threat. Now, have a listen to this, because it's quite interesting. When I first met Martin McGuinness in October 1997, I declined to shake his hand. As far as I was concerned, he was a terrorist and a member of an organisation that had shot and wounded my father and put my brother on a death list for 8 years. A few months later, McGuinness called me and asked me if I would come to Derry incognito without telling the security crats, as he calls them. I agreed, and he put himself at risk there. I agreed and flew to Belfast, took a taxi to Derry, and stood on a street corner feeling foolish. Two men with shaved heads approached me and pushed me into the back of a taxi and drove me around for an hour until I was completely lost. They let me out by a house on the edge of a neat little estate. I knocked on the door, and McGuinness came to the door on crutches, making an unfunny joke about kneecapping. I spent 3 hours in the living room talking to him. The lady of the house had gone out, asking no questions, but leaving tea and sandwiches. We didn't make any breakthroughs, but it became clear to me in the course of the conversation that the only way to make peace is to talk to your enemies and treat them as you would want to be treated yourself. I spent the next decade flying across the Irish Sea to meet the Sinn Féin leader, Gerry Adams, and McGuinness in safe houses in Belfast and Dublin. We eventually got to a lasting peace agreement in 2007. So, there you go, listeners. Do you talk to your enemies? Is this now applicable to what's going on in today's world? What would you regard Martin McGuinness as, a terrorist, peacemaker, or soldier? Was it terrorism, or was it war? We want to hear from you here at Trax FM on The Big Debate. More up on Martin McGuinness after the music break in London.
Judge Jim's Big Debate on Trax FM.
Step closer, and you know that I want you. I can tell by your eyes that you want me to. Just a question of time. I knew we'd be together, and that you'd be mine. I want you here forever. Do you hear what I'm saying? I gotta say how I feel. I can't believe you're here, but I know that you will. I know what I want, and baby, it's you. You can't deny my feelings because they are true, yeah. Dreams can come true. You and me, baby, I'm with you. You know we got to have fun. You know we got to be sure. Dreams can come true. You and me, baby, I'm with you. You know we got to have fun. You know we got to be sure.
Judging's Big Debate, son of Alex Ross, featuring Dakota and T-Pain. Great track. Good friend of Trax FM, Alex Ross. You're listening to Judge Jim's Big Debate, a jam-packed show. Take it away, Judge.
Yes, thanks for that, Dave. I'm just having a look, an examination of... before I do that with Martin McGuinness, I just wanted to say... What did I want to say? Oh, God, it's gone right out of my mind now. It'll come back to me. Oh, look, we'll just go carry on with the Martin McGuinness. Oh, that was it. That was what I wanted to say. And you can archive this. Look at the archives on the Big Debate. Take your pick. Go back to when we covered, and I think we were the first, if memory serves me right, to break the Lee Rigby's story live on air. We were the first. And we're certainly not mainstream media. But when we examined that in some depth some weeks ago, after the incident and we started getting in some mainstream media material, it turned out that the two suspected terrorists, the two terrorists have been convicted of that now, the two terrorists involved in that murder on Lee Rigby had actually been interviewed and suggested by The Guardian, and I remember this as clear as day, for working for either MI5 or MI6. Obviously, I don't have that newspaper article on me, but I'm sure if you went away and Googled it, you could find some lead on it that would be reliable. Moreover, you could actually track down one of the big debate shows and narrow it down to that. I don't know which one it would be. It was a couple of years ago now, but I do remember that. So it'd be interesting to see if any of these people that have been involved in today's tragic events have any connection whatsoever to British or any other national security service, because you've got to take on board that these people have access to firearms, and anything can be a weapon. It's even harder to turn something conventional into a weapon, so, and to learn how to drive evasively, defensively, and all that, you've got to be trained in it. So be interesting to see in the coming days, weeks, the analysis of who these people were. And I'll say it again, with that Lee Rigby event, the two people that are involved in that, I can't remember their names, they're in Belmarsh now, they were contacted and trained by, it was either MI5 or MI6 or both. Okay, so bear that in mind when you're looking at this whole incident. How do these people know how to do these things and carry out these atrocities? And how do you mentally discipline yourself to do something like that? But anyway, look, we're turning back to Martin McGuinness. So you've heard the Chief of Staff, what he had to say. Now, you've got to understand where Martin McGuinness was coming from, the things that he saw. And this is a lesson, really, for everybody that's listening about today, 7/7, 9/11, the whole thing. Sinn Féin politician who went from being an IRA commander to Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland. It's a very long article. I'm going to keep it for a couple of days and read it, I have to say. But I've picked out some bits that I think might try and get our learned listeners out there to grasp what goes on. Martin McGuinness, who has died aged 66 after suffering from a genetic disorder, was the former IRA commander who became Sinn Féin's chief negotiator in Northern Ireland, in the Northern Ireland peace process that led to the Good Friday Agreement of 1998. 9 years later, he entered power-sharing government with the Democratic Unionist Ian Paisley and continued to serve as Deputy First Minister with Peter Robinson and Arlene Foster until his resignation in January this year as a result of Foster's refusal to stand down an inquiry into a bungled energy scheme. McGuinness was still a teenager when fate propelled him into violent politics in his native Derry. Pictures in 1968 of Gerry Fitt, the Catholic MP for West Belfast, splashed with blood after being hit by police batons as he led a civil rights march, shocked him into activism. He started just as the IRA, having been stood down after abortive border campaigns in the 1950s, was arming. IRA leaders saw him as capable of providing organisation in Derry to mirror what Gerry Adams was developing in Belfast. Within months, McGuinness was second in command of the IRA Derry Brigade, the position he held on the 30th of January 1972, which was known as Bloody Sunday, when British Parachute Regiment soldiers shot dead 13 unarmed Catholic demonstrators. So when you look at today, what's the difference? One's wearing a uniform, one's not wearing a uniform. In March 1972, the Conservative Prime Minister Edward Heath suspended the Northern Ireland government at Stormont and imposed direct rule. William Whitelaw, the Northern Ireland Secretary, sought secret talks with the IRA. So any government minister that tells you or broadcasts they don't deal with terrorists are telling you one big fat lie, because they always have done. Remember, Margaret Thatcher used to say, we don't deal with terrorists, but she was. It says its leaders Sean McStuffian and Seamus Tommy, wanting the voice of young activists to be heard, picked McGuinness and Adams to join the six-strong delegation to fly to London. McGuinness and Adams already knew each other from the barricades, but the trip gave them an invaluable insight into the powerful British political establishment and cemented a lifelong friendship and political partnership. Well, I could read on and on and on with that article. And there's a picture of the pair of them together, and that's featured on page 34 of today's Guardian. It's a massive article about stuff and what they'd done and all the rest of it. But there you go, 1968, a peaceful demonstration led by a Catholic MP was bashed up by police. I mean, crikey, there you go. That's where it all started, all of the IRA... Well, the IRA campaign in Northern Ireland. There's people out there that are more expert in the historic IRA. When you look at Southern Ireland and the Black and Tans, the potato famine and the Irish question, and then we're going right back in to Victorian times. So you can get a flavour of why they had sympathisers and why they would consider it a war. And the British government and their supporters would call it terrorism. So applying the same science to what happened today, there's a message in there somewhere, isn't there? And if any government tells you they're not talking or dealing with terrorists, it's an absolute fib. It's a big fat lie. But one thing, there isn't a big fat lie in the next music break. It's over to you in London, Dave.
Judge Jim's Big Debate on Trax FM.
The victims we know so well, they shine in your eyes when they kiss and tell. Strange places we never see, but you're always there, like a ghost in my dream. And I keep on telling you, please don't do the things you do. When you do those things, pull my puppet strings, have the strangest void for you. We love and we never tell what places our hearts in the wishing well. Love leads us into the stream, and it sink or swim like it's always been. And I keep on loving you, it's the only thing to do. When the angel sings, there are greater things, can I give them all to you? Pull the strings of emotion, take a ride into unknown pleasure. Feel like a child on a dark night, wishing there was some kind of heaven. I could be warm with you smiling. Hold out your hand for a while. The victims, know them so well, so shine in your eyes when they kiss and tell. Strange places we never see, but you're always there, like a ghost in my dream. And I keep on telling you, please don't do the things you do. When you do those things, my puppet strings have the strangest void for you.
Yeah, the wonderful sound of Culture Club and the Victims. You're listening to Judge Jim's Big Debate. It is a jam-packed show with unfortunate events going on this afternoon. Judge is quite right, actually. In the 70s and certainly up to the mid-80s, we had to put up with lots and lots and lots of terrorist attacks in London. In London, for sure. And I do believe they were terrorists as well. Anyway, take it away, Judge.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I've just got to do a shout-out. I've got a listener out there in Hertfordshire called Kelly. Good evening. Thanks for tuning in to the Big Debate and taking the time to listen to my dulcet tones once again. We're dealing at the moment with Martin McGuinness, and, of course, there's all sorts of news flashes and whatnot kicking off on Twitter about today's tragic events in London, and it's kind of not strange, but it's there's some parallel in this Martin McGuinness funeral as to where terrorism starts and where it all ends up at, and I'm reading various articles out from different newspapers. I've got the Times in front of me, by the way, right now, just to try and keep things a bit balanced. Not too unbalanced, otherwise I've got the Mail or the Telegraph, perhaps. But in the centre, not in the centre, page six and seven, it features how Bobby Sands paved the way to the power-sharing deal. The boost in support for Sinn Féin after the hunger strikes led to the end of the Troubles, Richard Ford writes for the Times. It was a massive story capturing newspaper headlines around the world, but few could have imagined that it would eventually lead to Republicans entering government in Northern Ireland. Bobby Sands' death on the 66th day of his hunger strike in the Mays prison was a seminal moment in the Troubles and marked the start of Sinn Féin's move towards constitutional politics. Now, this word Troubles, this is what the press over here use, and I'm sure there's quarters in Ireland and whatnot which call it a war, but it's always been dubbed over here as Troubles. Nine more prisoners were to die in the 1981 hunger strike, with Republicans banging bin lids on the pavements and blowing whistles to alert their community to another death. On the streets, the deaths would be followed by rioting and violence. Large crowds would go to the homes of the dead men to file past a usually open coffin, often draped in a flag, on which were placed the volunteers' black beret and gloves. Masked men wearing berets would appear at the graveside and fire a volley of shots over the coffin before disappearing into the crowd. The hunger strikes finally ended when some families took their men off the protest, but out of it grew the notion of a twin-track Republican campaign. IRA violence coupled with Sinn Féin electoral gains, building on the support it had galvanised among nationalists during the hunger strike. And there's various pictures that go right back. There's Martin McGuinness holding a pistol. He seems to know what to do with that, I have to say. He stood there with Gerry Adams at a funeral, by the looks of it. Pictures of Enniskillen, there's another tragic turn of events in 1987. Picture of Norman Tebbit being stretchered out of the Brighton hotels. That's back in, when was that? That was in 1984. That's right, the Brighton bomb. There he is again, centre stage, shaking hands with the Queen. I mean, have we learned nothing in this world? That's what I have to ask. That it starts off where big power goes to another part of its community or the world, and it introduces such inequality. Now, Northern Ireland, if you were Catholic, you wouldn't get any work. You wouldn't be considered a job. It's just incredible. I mean, in this day and age, to even think about that. So just by looking at this, you can put the parameters in today's world and sort of try and understand where all this is coming from. Except I think it's a bit more evil nowadays, but that's probably because I'm an adult living in it, not a child. So yeah, that's you know, a sample of what life was like for in Northern Ireland in the 80s. I mean, it even goes on to say that you couldn't take your cars anywhere. All the pubs closed on a Sunday. The Europa Hotel was constantly bombed, and that's where the Times newspaper had an office. It's incredible, really. If you put inequality into a place, if some people have it and some people don't have it, you're going to create grievances. So the first thing they do is peaceful protesting. That doesn't work. Then they escalate it. And the escalation then goes to violence. And then when you get through the violence stage, it's funny, you go back to the peaceful stage. Why does the violence have to take place when you're going to go back to the peaceful place anyway? I'm not saying you can give every Tom, Dick and Harry a seat at the table, but you do have to take a good look at yourself. Look at today, look at 7-7. You're sending drones halfway around the world to take out communities. You know, it's like a video game. You sat at your laptop in some RAF base somewhere up north and you're controlling a drone somewhere in the Middle East. Oh, yeah, just take that building out. Bosh, bang, gone. But violence shouldn't breed violence, should it? But we need to look at ourselves. We need to look back and learn from the past. And I think we're clearly not doing that at all in the Western world, certainly. Anyway, look, it's 7:30. The time's flying. It's only on a lighter note. Look, you've got to have a bit of a lighter note. Last week we done the big debate, and it coincided. Right, I just said that for Dave's benefit. Right, I used to have this old chair at conference called Pat O'Hara. That's what you see. Right, and it was Cheltenham week, and we do a pre-call before we go live on air, and I said, look, I'm really struggling for news, but this week I've been inundated with stuff. I'm not even a 10% of the way up the page yet. Anyway, shut up, keep talking. I'll tell you what I'm going to do, listeners. I'm going to park up the Martin McGuinness thing for now, but I'm going to stick with let's have a look at terrorism, but at another part of the world. Hang on, I've just got to just find the page number it's on. It's in The Guardian, page 21. And for those of you that have never listened to the big debate before, the reason why I use newspapers is so I can quote them as a source. Because how many people do you know? When you go, well, you'll find out. When you go to work tomorrow or down your local pub or cafe or whatever, there'll be plenty of people with their opinions, and you'll say to them, well, I had it myself. I was talking to someone down the road from me about a criminal court case that I can't go into. And they said, well, I bet if it was a Muslim, the police would still be round there. And I simply say, well, I don't know about that. And he said, well, it would. And I'll say, well, have you got any statistics to back that up? 9 times out of 10, they haven't. So that's why we have the newspapers, because, as you've noticed, we can quote them and say, well, that's where we got that from. And the liability is then passed onto the paper. But if you've got reliable newspapers and media sources, you've got nothing to worry about, have you? Okay, right. Found it now. I'll carry on. It's a good job I've had my dinner, isn't it? Theft from oil pipeline, funds, wait for this, drug cartels and terrorism. Robin Hood effect makes crime difficult to tackle. Researchers surprised at the extent of the problem in the European Union. Oil theft and other hydrocarbon crimes are funding terrorist groups and drug cartels around the world, a new analysis says. Mexican drug gangs can earn $90,000 in 7 minutes by tapping a pipeline of refined oil while insurgents in Nigeria financially benefit from a share of the third of Nigeria's refined oil exports lost to theft, said the Atlantic Council. The Washington-based think tank, which mapped the scale of crime in the oil refining and processing end of the sector, said the issue had largely been ignored by the authorities. Donkeys, believe it or not, laden with jerry cans are used to smuggle oil across the closed border from oil-rich Algeria to Morocco. As a result, an estimated 660,000 cars in Morocco and Tunisia run on fuel smuggled from Algeria. And border cities have sprung up to provide a property market to launder some of the funds. Many drops start to flood a house, said Raubi of the Community of Impact. As well as Nigeria, Mexico is an oil theft hotspot where an estimated $1 billion of oil is stolen each year. Now, this is the point, right? You've got that idiot in the White House going on about terrorism and drugs and this and that and how bad the Mexicans are. Instead of building that great colossal wall that he'll never complete, let alone get started, why don't he divert some of his funds in fighting and policing oil pipelines? I just don't understand it. Anyway, I interrupted the article there. With the Zetas cartel controlling nearly 40% of that market, drug barons tapping pipelines in Mexico were also known to leave them open afterwards for farmers to win support. You see, you can starve the people some of the time, but you can't starve them all the time. Europe is not exempt from the problem, with the analysis finding that the EU lost about 4 billion euros in hydrocarbon revenues in 2012. That's a lot of money. Raubi said a huge industry was taking shape involving refined crude, wait for it, drum roll, from these countries such as Libya, which has Africa's largest oil reserves, being illegally transferred ship to ship in the Mediterranean and passed off as legitimate oil imports to the EU. And it goes on as quoted as saying, "We are somewhat surprised to see the extent of ongoing criminality within the EU. Many people believe this is just a developing state phenomena." So it's absolutely incredible. You could be driving, believe it or not, terrorist or drug-financed oil in your car, or fuel, petrol, if you like. How about that, eh? So before you send off half your armed forces around the world to go and invade a country that's not got past the Stone Age, have a look at these things. Get these basics right, first of all. I mean, there's about, what, $6 billion, I think, if I just tot it up quickly, in 1 year alone, that we, through taxation as well, and imports of oil, have financed terrorism and drug cartels. So that car in London today, driven on Westminster Bridge, may have been purchased through us buying petrol and oil using these methods. So I tell you, it beggars belief, it really does. Dave, I'm afraid I'm going to have to give it back to you for a music break.
Contact Judge Jim's Big Debate on Skype, Trax Big Debate, Twitter, this is Jim Trax FM. Email thebigdebate at traxfm.org. Join the Trax FM chat room, www.traxfm.org. Trax FM, the original 103.3 Pirates.
Sing this.
Jim's Big Debate, son of Gary Newman and Tubeway Army. Don't forget, I'll be up in 18 minutes and 10 o'clock, DJ Chris. I was talking to Judge offline, and I'm of the firm belief. Have a look at YouTube and stuff. Look, our thoughts go out to the family of all those who died and were injured today. Family, friends, our thoughts and tracks of him, I promise you. But have a look on YouTube and have a look and get a balanced view on what happened today and why. I'm not going to say, I'll leave that to Judge if he decides to do that, but just look at that stuff. 9/11, the Bush family, American politics, the IRA, Provos, all sorts, and you'll get a balanced view. Some of it's a bit wacky, but it will give you a balanced view on politics, the CIA, the MI5. If you've not watched Homelands, watch it, right? The intelligence from the Americans and certainly the UK are clamping down on these people. We started off with aeroplanes in 2001, and now we're limited to just them driving cars. But again, foreign policy, Judge covered this off many shows. Foreign policy, is it working? Enough of me rambling, take it away, Judge.
Thanks for that, Dave. Gives my voice a rest anyway. Of course, you mentioned the US government. This government is the government that even killed their own president, JFK. There you go. Say no more. There's an article here that I really want to mention. And by the way, if you're a member of Royal Mail and you're listening, or you're not listening, or you should be listening, you'll have a ballot paper through your door. For NEC PEC election, when we get a very low return, I say we, I mean the union, the CWU, get a very low return on people that nationally are representing your interests and the money and your terms and conditions in your pocket. So take the time to fill them out and send them back, please. All right? Please. I know you can do it, because there's more people that voted on the European Union referendum than the general election, so you can do it, all right? So get that filled out. And he said he'd be listening tonight. I don't know if he is or not, but try and put your name across against Mr. Andy Hopping, all right? Make sure he gets on. He's a good lad. And Tony Bush, by the way. Seen him in action. He's good. Right. Okay, look. This is something else featured in the Guardian. Courier. was punished for refusing work. A cycle courier in central London told a tribunal he was punished for refusing work after 8 hours of cycling in snowy weather, and said he received no paid breaks or holiday pay. Andrew Boxer is the latest to attempt to be classified as a worker, then an independent contractor. As a contractor for Excel, a courier firm taken over by rival firm City Sprint last October. Boxer is not entitled to the minimum wage, holiday pay, sickness benefit or a pension. His case is the latest in a string of tribunals against gig economy employers, and the second of four relating to employment status of couriers being backed by Independent Workers Union of Great Britain. All four cases are being overseen by Joanna Wade, the judge who ruled in January that City Sprint had wrongly classed courier Max Dewhurst as self-employed. City Sprint is appealing. Boxer told the Central London Employment Tribunal yesterday that he could not turn down work during a shift or take time off without prior arrangements and had no official break times. He said people are scared of not getting work and losing the job because the power's in the controller's hands. Boxer said the only occasion he could recall turning down a job was after an 8-hour shift in pouring rain and intermittent snow. He said he was told by his controller that as a result he would not be given time off to attend acting auditions when he needed it. So good luck with that, Andrew Boxer. You probably aren't listening, but there's plenty of people out there that feel for you. There'll be plenty of people in about a month's time that will be talking about this, if they're not too busy talking about other nonsense, in Bournemouth, I believe. So, yeah, we'll keep an eye out for that one. Certainly. Good. Very good. These people are bringing it to the forefront and it's getting into the media. And we here on Tracks FM can expose these gig employers for what they are. Nothing less and nothing more than charlatans. Okay, right, let's have a look. Looking at the agenda here, agenda piece of paper. What do we want to look at now? I mean, I've got Donald Trump on here. We've got 13 minutes to go. Let's have a look. What do we fancy? Let's have a look. Covert police hackers. That was on the front of The Guardian, wasn't it? Oh, good job, I've got it in my hand still, The Guardian, that is. Let's have a look here. All right. Okay. You like that, don't you, Dave? Right. It's a nice watch you've got on. Right. See, I've got to stop doing it. Okay, let's get my desk light on this. This is what the police were doing, the Met Police. This is how this government treats you, let alone these people that drive down pavements on Westminster Bridge. This is what they're doing, right? Okay, the police watchdog is investigating allegations that a secretive Scotland Yard unit used hackers to illegally access the private emails of hundreds of political campaigners and journalists. So that's people like probably anyone on Tracks FM, trade unionists, environmentalists, that sort of thing. The allegations were made by an anonymous individual who says the unit worked with Indian police. So this is where the legal loophole comes in, who in turn used hackers to illegally obtain the passwords of the email accounts of the campaigners and some reporters and press photographers. The person who says he or she previously worked for the intelligence unit that monitors the activities of political campaigners detailed their concerns in a letter to the Green Party peer Jenny Jones. The peer passed on the allegations to the Independent Police Complaints Commission, the IPCC, which is investigating. Hacked passwords were passed to the Metropolitan Police Unit, according to the writer of the letter. The unit then regularly checked the emails of the campaigners and the media to gather information. The letter to Jones listed the passwords of environmental campaigners, four of whom were from Greenpeace. Several confirmed they matched the ones they had used to open their emails. The letter also alleges that emails of reporters and photographers, including two working for The Guardian, were monitored. a spokesperson for The Guardian said allegations that the Metropolitan Police had accessed the email accounts of Guardian journalists are extremely concerning, and we expect a full and thorough investigation into these claims. But what's interesting, listeners, is that they went to India to get this piece of work done, the hacking and whatnot. So they've obviously been legally advised somewhere by someone to take the issue abroad. A bit like when we, when was it, when we arrested suspected of terrorists abroad, what we were doing was we weren't holding them in custody here. We'd move them to somewhere like Guantanamo Bay where they had no rights, and we're using torture methods that weren't compliant with the Geneva Convention and international law. And this is obviously, to me, this is what's going on here. So even if you did have legislation in place by a domestic UK parliament, all the police would do is have an agency based abroad, probably outside the EU, as close as Africa possibly, and they'd run the checks through there, and they could prove that the IP address would come from there, from another police force, and they had in fact received a tip-off. So very dangerous, this, isn't it, if you think about it? And the kind of people that they're monitoring aren't as half as dangerous as the people today, for that matter. So what is it? I know Greenpeace have had their moments, but Guardian journalists, I mean, they are the people that did, of course, reveal the Snowden revelations. A film, by the way, well worth looking at. Very interesting. So, yes, covert police unit accused of using hackers to spy on protests on the front of The Guardian, that is. Okay, Dave, I think I'd better hand over for a music break in London.
Judge Jim's Big Debate on Trax FM.
Played the fiddle in an Irish band, but she fell in love with an Englishman. Kissed her on the neck and then I took her by the hand, said, baby, I just wanna dance. I met her on Grafton Street, right outside of the bar. She shared a cigarette with me while her brother played the guitar. What does it mean, the Gaelic ink on your arm? Said it was one of my friend's songs. Do you wanna drink off? She took Jamie as a chaser, Jack for the fun. She got Arthur on the table with Johnny riding a shotgun. Tired to drink and we'll drink at the bar. Then put Ben on the jukebox, got up to dust. She played the fiddle in an Irish band, but she fell in love with an Englishman. Kissed her on the neck and then I took her by the hand. Said, baby, I just wanna dance. I'm ready to go. And then she beat me at pool, and then she kissed me like there was nobody else in the room. Last orders were called was when she stood on the stool, after dancing to Kaylee singing to trad tunes. I never heard Carrie Burgers ever sung so sweet. A cappella in the bar using a beat for a beat, or I can have that track playing on repeat for a week. In this packed out room where she was singing to me. You know she played the fiddle in an Irish band, but she fell in love with an Englishman. Kissed her on the neck and then I took her by the hands. And baby, I just wanna dance. Stayed a welcome and it's closing time. I was holding her hand, the hand was holding mine. Our coats both smell of smoke, whiskey and wine. As we filled up her lungs with the cold air of the night, I walked her home, then she took me inside. Finished some Doritos and another bottle of wine. I swear I'm gonna put you in a song that I write about a good way to go and a perfect night. She played the fiddle in an Irish band, but she fell in love with an Englishman. Kissed her on the neck and then I took her by the hands. Baby, I just wanted.
Ed Sheeran and Galway Girl. You're listening to Judge Jim's Big Debate. Yeah, we got news today. A lot of it terrible, but also putting things into context. Very important, that. Putting things into context. But again, I'll reiterate, for all those injured and the people passed away today, listen, we're utter condolences, 100% condolences to family and friends of those families. Anyway, Judge, take it away.
Yeah, thanks, Dave, for that. That's wholeheartedly those families out there that may have lost loved ones. You do have our condolences here from Trax FM, and hats off to the emergency services for doing your thing. You are the best, number one, to say the least. Right, okay, look, turning back to the big debate, it probably takes to the close before David RB. He's up at the top of the hour. We need to know if the president's a crook. This is according to David K. Johnston, featured on page 31 of today's Guardian. What I've uncovered makes it clear exactly why Donald Trump should publish his tax returns now. It's a probing article, to say the least. I don't think I'm going to have time to read all that, but I'll cut to the chase. Why do we need to see Donald Trump's tax returns? That's the number one question asked by critics of the story I broke last week on DCRReport.org. After the president's 2005 tax return summary pages showed up on the 13th of March in the mail at my home in Rochester, New York. It's a question I am happy to answer as a long-time tax reporter, a Trump biographer, and a citizen who has known Trump for almost 30 years. We need to see years of tax returns for every major party candidate for president and vice president because, as Richard Nixon said during Watergate, people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Okay, Nixon, it turned out, was a crook. While he was not indicated, his tax lawyer went to prison. Among majority party candidates and presidents since then, only Trump has refused to release any tax information. The obvious question is, what is he hiding? Well, David K. Johnston says in one word, plenty. Without his complete tax return since the 1970s, we have no way of knowing whether he is a crook or compromised by his extensive dealings with Russian oligarchs or with authoritarian regimes in Azerbaijan, the Philippines and Turkey, or by massive loans from banks owned by the Chinese government and the Trump Tower space rented by the largest tenant, Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. We do know from court records that Trump was embroiled in a sales tax scandal. He was named as one of the celebrities who bought items at the Bulgari jewelry store in Manhattan without the necessary taxes being paid. Ed Koch, when he was mayor of New York, suggested those involved should have served 15 days behind bars for this. Yet then, as now, Trump was bullish in his own defense. His spokesman said Trump was never part of the scam and had made only a bona fide purchase. Now, fast forwarding a bit, imagine if, as president, and we can because he hasn't laid it to rest, has he? Imagine if, as President Trump, gets financially squeezed, as he was in 1990 when he had a negative net worth, and in 2008 when he claimed he could not repay a $40 million debt. What leverage could Bank of China, to which Trump owes many millions of dollars, bring to bear? It is owned by a communist government in Beijing. On the other hand, what if they forgave Trump debts in order to seek favorable foreign policy and military objectives? During the campaign, Trump repeatedly said he would release his tax returns once the audits were complete. After assuming office, he said he had no intention of ever making the public, despite mounting questions about his relationships with the Russians involving at least one wildly lucrative deal at a time when he said the entire US real estate market was in collapse. The same year, Trump sold a Russian for a $95 million plus commission, a Florida estate he had bought for less than $41 million 4 years earlier. Today, the land sits vacant. The mansion bulldozed. According to Reuters, Russians have invested over $100 million in other Trump buildings. These are matters of public record cited in my book, The Making of Donald Trump. Now, I'll just finish off with this. By his own account, Trump has had extensive dealings with Russians for over 30 years, so we should now think about the financial links. So there you go. It won't go away, will it? The Russian connection. It will not go away. There's something subliminal there. Not just money, but something else. But look, I've had fun this evening, despite those tragic events in London today. I'm going to hand you over to David RB now for the next 2 hours for a bit of a, well, you're going to have a party and a relax and whatnot. I'd just like to thank everyone that took the time to tune in today. You've been listening to Judge Jim's Big Debate only on Tracks FM. See you next week. Good night and goodbye and stay safe.
Judge Jim's Big Debate on Tracks FM.